Chapter 12, History. 9 o'clock the next morning, I was sitting in math class and could barely wait for study hall. Okay, I know that sounds typical, but you need to realize that math usually is one of my favorite classes and that I was going to spend study hall going over my history research with Mr. Nawani. I know, weird, right? Math class was horribly dull today. We were plotting equations on graph paper, which was stuff we did in fourth grade. Okay, maybe plotting equations like y equals 8 times x plus 1 squared plus 10 was a little more complicated than what we did in Kilgore Elementary, but plotting a parabola wasn't much different than drawing a straight line. You just plugged in the numbers, solved the equation, sketched the little dots on the graph paper, and connected them with lines. Presenting my new theory to Mr. Nawani, however, was going to be anything but boring. Mr. Nawani stared at me as I walked into his classroom and remarked, "My, you appear enthusiastic this morning, Mr. Panagopoulos. Please do enlighten me with your findings." I pulled out the papers I had printed to let him read them, but he held up his hand and asked me to explain my hypothesis. Man, I was glad that I looked up what the term hypothesis means when I Googled the word premise. I've discovered that about every 1,200 years, a new religion or spiritual awakening occurs involving the number 7, I proudly said. "And why is that?" asked Mr. Nawani as he clenched his teeth. I don't really know. Maybe it's aliens, or maybe it's God, or maybe civilization just needs to reset every 1,000 years or so, I admitted. This wasn't going as well as I had hoped. "No, I'm not asking about your theory of a cause, although it is good that you have given it some thought," corrected Mr. Nawani. "I want to know how you came to the conclusion that this pattern is occurring." "Oh," I said with relief as I began my explanation. I had worked on this so much that I barely needed to look at my notes. I had learned that one of mankind's earliest religions formed between 3200 BCE and 1300 BCE in the Indus Valley near what is now India and Pakistan. The core of these Bronze Age people's beliefs involved the 7 chakra, which are the Sarasara, your crown, the Ajna, your third eye, the Vishuddhi, your throat, the Anahata, your heart, the Nabhi Manipura, your solar, the Svadhisthana, your sacral, and the Muladhara, your root. These 7 elements still exist in Hindu and Tantric Buddhism, as well as in a few other spiritualistic beliefs. Then the number 7 rose to prominence again in the Middle Kingdom of Egypt between 2050 BCE and 1640 BCE. That was when the ancient Egyptians compressed their belief in 9 souls down to 7 souls, and their empire flourished. The 7 souls are known as Ren, your secret name, Kaibit, your shadow or memory, Ba, your personality, Ka, your life essence, Ab, your heart, Sahu, your spirit, and Kat, your body. I was on a roll now and continued to explain how the ancient city of Rome was founded in 753 BCE on 7 hills called Aventinus, Palatinus, Caelius, Esquilinus, Viminalus, Quirinalus, and Capitolinus. The city built on the 7 hills lasted for nearly 300 years until it was sacked by the Gauls in 3090 BCE. The Romans fought back and rebuilt it and expanded their empire until 44 BCE when Julius Caesar was assassinated. That started a major civil war which eventually tore the empire apart. It lingered for another 400 years but was never the same. So I say the 7 hills of Rome had a powerful influence between 753 BC and 27 BCE. Which was when Octavian ended the civil war by defeating Mark Antony. Although I still wasn't clear on what the deal was with Mark and Cleopatra, or how they wound up in Egypt. I mean, how did those two ever meet up? Even I know that Italy and Egypt are in different continents. Wow, I guess I did learn some history while I was doing this. I paused and waited for Mr. Nawani's applause and look of astonishment. Instead, he closed his eyes and put his head in his hands for several minutes before speaking. "Mr. Panagopoulos, you've just listed 3 separate historical occurrences and tried to connect them with a simple timeline. First, you need to be much more specific, and second, 2 of those eras even overlap. I'm afraid that I don't see any pattern here." "But there is a pattern," I insisted. "You're right that these are eras and not specific dates, but you can plot specific dates occurring every 1,237 years, which land in each of these eras. The farther back you go in time, the broader the time span, simply because we don't have enough reliable information. I used 3160 BC as the point for the Indus Valley era. 1923 BCE is the point for Egypt, and 686 BCE as the point for ancient Rome. Three equidistant points in time are a pretty suspicious coincidence. Mr. Nawani looked up and asked, "But a fourth equidistant point would add even more weight to your theory, wouldn't it, Mr. Panagopoulos? Tell me how you concluded such a precise period. 1,237 years is quite a specific number." I was in shock. I had searched for something that happened in 551, but couldn't find anything. I did, however, learn that Cincinnati was founded in 1788, which was precisely 2,474 years, or 2 times 1,237 years after the Roman center point. I couldn't tell him that, though. He'd undoubtedly ask what that had to do with anything, and I really couldn't explain about the whole Seven Talismans of Mirth prophecy. I said, "Well, my calculations indicated that the interval needed to be about 1,240 years, and 1,237 is the nearest prime number. Everything about these spiritual beliefs seems to involve prime numbers, so I chose one on a hunch." I tensed up in preparation for the lecture on making guesses, but was surprised by Mr. Narwani's response. "Sometimes hunches can be very useful, as long as you carefully document when they are being made. Yours seems to be harmless enough, and you do have some marginal justification for making it. I seriously doubt that 5 or 10 years in either direction would make any difference. I am, however, very disappointed in you, Mr. Panagopoulos." My stomach felt like it dropped to my butt. I was lost and just stared at my instructor. "Oh, come on! What is your next data point if you extended your timeline?" asked Mr. Narwani. I knew this. In fact, I'd spent most of the night failing to find anything to tie in that date. I said, "The next date is the year 551. And what mystical stories take place around that time which involve the number 7? He asked with a knowing grin. I couldn't find anything other than beliefs arising about the 7 deadly sins in Christianity about that time. But I don't think that really fits the pattern, I admitted. Mr. Panagopoulos, I am proud of you, Mr. Narwani beamed. I really can't figure this guy out. I mean, I just admitted failure, and now he's proud of me? What's with that? Mr. Narwani continued, "You formed a hypothesis and searched for supporting data. A conspiracy theorist would have forced the data to fit the equation, but you chose to discount it. There is hope for you yet, young man." Thank you, I muttered. Now, what legendary figure roamed about England with his famous group of friends somewhere between the years 300 and 600? Asked Mr. Nawani. This is your area of expertise, is it not?
I don't know. But I was trying to focus on historical events regarding mysticism and the number 7 and not legends, I replied. I sensed a trap. Perhaps Mr. Narwani was testing me.
Legends are often rooted in fact, said Mr. Narwani with a wave of his hand. I'll give you a hint. The fellow I'm thinking of pulled a sword out of a stone.
King Arthur?
But even I know that he was just a legend. Besides, his quest was to find the Holy Grail. It had nothing to do with the number 7, I complained.
And that is why you need to study history, young man. Arthur's hunt for the Grail wasn't his only quest, laughed Mr. Narwani. You would know that if you took the time to understand history and not just listen to the stories. What did it mean when Arthur pulled the sword out of the stone?
It meant that he was the one true king of England, I answered. I still didn't know where he was going with this, but he was happy, and he was right. The Arthurian tales were something I knew.
Correct, Mr. Panagopoulos, although he probably would not have used the word England. And do you think that everyone immediately recognized him as their king and obediently bowed before him?
Probably not, I agreed.
Then would you not say that his real quest was to unite the various kingdoms of his time into one country? He asked, raising his finger with finality as though he were victorious in proving his point.
Yeah? So what? I asked. I still wasn't understanding the significance.
Mr. Narwani looked as though he was going to explode. He wasn't angry, really, but I could tell he was frustrated. He had to think I was the dumbest student he ever had. I'm sorry, Mr. Panagopoulos. I forgot that you probably haven't studied this era of history yet, but it happens to be my favorite. There are two possibilities for you to consider for your model, because the majority of what we now call England, Scotland, and Wales was controlled by two different groups of people. The eastern part of the island we call Great Britain consisted of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms called East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, Wessex, Essex, Kent, and Sussex in the 6th century. These seven kingdoms were known as the Heptarchy and were eventually united into a single country we now call England. I was astounded. I couldn't believe it. Everything fit. I had been standing in front of Mr. Narwani's desk this entire time, but suddenly felt the need to sit down. It sure would have been nice if there had been a chair there, but yeah, I didn't really hurt myself when I landed on the floor. Mr. Narwani raced around his desk to help me up. "Are you all right, Mr. Panagopoulos?" he asked with genuine concern. "Yes, thank you," I answered. "I just can't believe that it's true. I thought I was onto something, but started to doubt it when I couldn't find anything in 551. "Well, don't relax quite yet," chuckled Mr. Narwani as he helped me pull up a desk chair. "There are a couple of problems with this theory. You see, Arthur wasn't Anglo-Saxon. He was a Briton. Who were the folks who controlled the western side of the island we now call Scotland, Wales, and southwest England? The second problem is that England wasn't unified for another 500 years.
This is why I hate history in general and Mr. Narwani in particular. He crushed all my hope and amazement in an instant, and I felt lost again. Why did he even mention the Heptarchy if he knew it wasn't the answer?
Mr. Narwani must have recognized my dismay because he quickly continued.
"Don't despair, Mr. Panagopoulos. Consider that legendary tales are often based upon historical elements which are adapted to meet the needs of the current rulers. The oldest documented Arthurian tales were written after England was unified, so their author would naturally describe him as the once and future king of England rather than the leader of his original country. Uther Pendragon's castle is popularly placed in Scotland, but I believe that it was more likely that Arthur Pendragon lived in the region we now know as Wales. Not much is known about Wales at that time. It consisted of numerous tribes or small kingdoms. However, scholars generally believe that there were seven major Welsh kings. Two ruled parts of Gwent, while the others ruled the Welsh kingdoms of Gwynedd, Powys, Ceredigion, Dyfed, and Glywysing. So what, I interrupted, while it is convenient that there were seven kings, my whole theory is based upon times of great social change. The Britons were the losers. Even I know enough in American history to know we fought the Revolutionary War against King George of England and not King George of Wales. So all of this is nothing more than a stupid story. We sat in silence for several minutes while I saw my theory and my extra credit grade go up in smoke. How could I have been such an idiot? Mr. Narwani was right. I have no idea how to really do research, and I know nothing about history. Mr. Narwani softly said, "Mark, you have the potential to be a great researcher." I thought, wait, what is he talking about? Did he just call me Mark? Mr. Narwani continued, "You don't just look at the facts. You see how they relate and use that relationship to develop understanding, and you evidently pay more attention to my class than your test scores indicate. However, your definition of winners and losers might need a little work. Did you know that the Britons at the time were Christian while the Anglo-Saxons worshipped religions which were later called pagan? Yet, England was formed as a Christian country. The Britons did more than fend off the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy for hundreds of years. They dramatically influenced their culture and society. After all, King George might have been English, but the American Revolution was fought against the British. So Arthur could be real, or just a metaphor for unifying the Britons, or even just the Welsh, enough to sufficiently thwart Saxon expansion and extend the Britons' influence. This influence would ultimately hasten the spread of Christianity around the world and could have occurred sometime around your predicted date of 551. The bell rang to change classes, and he concluded, "But please remember that all this number seven business is nonsense. After all, I am not aware of any mystical event happening 1,237 years later in 1788.
but I am very proud of your research and analysis effort. Put this into a report, and I will give you your extra credit." "Thank you," I said as I stood to leave. My mind was spinning with what Mr. Normani had said. "By the way, did you know that Cincinnati was founded on Seven Hills in 1788? "Well, I am impressed with your knowledge of local history. Do you think this is relevant to your theory?" he suspiciously asked. "It was just an observation, nothing more," I lied. 5 data points aligned across 6,000 years? Wait until I tell the guys." I was happier than I could ever remember feeling as I was walking to lunch with Tyler, Ethan, and Chantel. I even waved to Nancy Wellington when she passed. She paused and said, "Hey, I thought of you fantasy game guys this morning. I had the strangest dream about dragons last night." Ethan elbowed me and hissed, "I'm telling you that she's one of the Earth heroes. You have to ask her out now. It's fate." I don't know if I agreed with this assessment, but I was feeling so good that I gave it a shot. "That's funny, Nancy. By the way, what do you think about going to the costume dance?" I asked in my most casual voice. "Oh, I don't want to go. I hate those things, and besides, I have a soccer tournament early the next morning," Nancy replied as she turned and walked away.
"Scorch! You were burned down, my man," laughed Tyler.
"No, technically he wasn't," disagreed Chantel. "She never said she didn't want to go with Mark. She said she didn't want to go to the dance." "I'm not sure she even realized he was asking her to go out with him," chuckled Ethan.
"Hey, I'm taking it as a win. I made my move, and the most popular girl in school didn't laugh in my face," I said, thinking about what Dad told me last night. And I really meant it.
"True words," agreed Tyler. "More guts than either of us," seconded Ethan with the obligatory fist bump. "I'll go to the dance with you," said Chantel. She saw my startled face and quickly added, "Chill, it's a costume party, not a prom date." "Sounds like a plan," I answered. I was still feeling good, despite being rejected by Nancy, if that was even what had happened. In fact, I was feeling great.